gives me great pleasure to welcome Debjani Bhattacharya, who is currently at Drexel University in Philadelphia, but did her PhD at Emory and has taught in other places, including Jadavpur. Debjani is working on a sort of interface between land, property and law in the Bengal Delta, I think, and is in the process of turning her PhD into a book. Are we getting some of that today?
Some of that, yeah.
Yes, today. Yeah. So she's going to talk to us about a naturally forming harbour, silt geological testimony and law in the Bengal Delta. Debjani.
Thank you. Thank you so much for the introduction, and thank you everybody for coming out here. It's actually a great honour for me to share my work with all of you. So as Professor Washbrook mentioned, I will talk a little bit from my forthcoming book, but some of the but I'm pushing some of the conceptual ideas that I deal with in this chapter further to that forays into my new kind of work, which will be more about geological evidence and law. So to briefly summarize my book, it began as an attempt to write the history of urban land and property market of Calcutta. I saw there's so much an agrarian property, why not urban? Maybe someone should write it. But within 2 weeks in the archive, I realized a lot of the property debates, especially from the 18th and early 19th century, were about the marshy nature and the swamp, and how to demarcate land and water. Where does landed property rights end and water rights begin, basically? In spite of major schemes to dry and drain Calcutta or Kolkata, water seems to continue the history, and it's still not a frictionless element in the city's continued expansion to its marshy eastern hinterlands or fringes. So what I understood was there are many routes to understanding the genealogy of property in colonial Bengal. Some of the well-researched points of entry have been through the intellectual history of property regimes, while others have focused on settlement histories or treatment of property claims in courts. Avoiding these approaches in this talk, I will take silt, or to be more precise, the intractable soil-water admixture for understanding the material and social processes of making property in swamp. Swamp, as many historians, especially Iftikhar Iqbal, Nitin Sinha, Rohan D'Souza, and here also Arup Jyotishaikya, have pointed out, created havoc for the East India Company with regards to measuring property and revenue, and they also disrupted the laying of infrastructure, railroads, roads, harbour, docks, in a mobile landscape. So I'll begin this talk with a brief overview of one of the early attempts to construct a harbour for Calcutta, not in Calcutta, in the 18th century. This harbour failed. And in many ways, it's a very minor event in the larger changes in the East India Company's history at the time. However, the failure helps us understand something about the evolution of laws regarding ownership of land and water, and helps us reflect on the relation between law, geography, and the emerging earth sciences. During the latter half of the 18th century, precisely 1776, an erstwhile British English draftsman turned private merchant named Benjamin Luckham was discovering all the possibilities that were embedded in the malleability of the silty coasts at the edge of the Bengal Delta. He was sure that the silt and that the tidal river Hooghly brought down to the flatlands forming the coasts along the delta on its way to the Bay of Bengal held a potential windfall for him. In 1774, after spending 13 years in Bengal, he sought a grant from the East India Company with the purpose of building wharves and dry docks. He was not wrong in his judgment, though his economically and ecologically speculative project to operationalize the harbour he built never saw the light of day. As the years went by, the vagaries of silt and the tides that make the delta turned his fortunes around, embroiling him in a 30-year-long legal battle from which he barely escaped the debtor's prison, and he also lost his honor and investments in Bengal. The failed harbor is important for understanding how the company managed the ecology of the tidal delta. In 1776, 2 months prior to the completion of his harbor, the company canceled his land grant over a dispute on the reported depth of water and therefore the possibilities of owning it. In 1777, Luckham filed his case with the Mayor's Court in Calcutta, and later that was transferred to London, finally settled in 1806. In his complaint, Luckham alleged that the company had cheated him of his anticipated profits by cancelling his grant illegitimately. The company, on the other hand, refuted his charges by arguing that Luckham's geographical measurements did not match the geological facts on ground, therefore raising questions about the economic viability of his plans. What does Luckham's failed harbour tell us about the changing nature of geographical knowledge, geological debates, and how they get written into the legal architecture around possession that was being crafted in Britain's Eastern Colony. And that's the question I'm trying to understand in this talk. In analyzing the terms through which the Mayor's Court in Calcutta, where his case was first heard, and then his petition to the House of Commons in London, this talk pursues the following lines of inquiry. Why and how did law become the basis for managing these spaces? What were the conditions that enabled also the legal straitjacketing of what came to be labeled as geographical difference and ecological variability in the tidal delta? Scholars have increasingly paid attention to the question of law, political authority in riverine geography, beyond their histories of dams and irrigation. These histories push the bounds of legal history's overwhelming focus on landed and oceanic geography. Historians like Lauren Benton, Tamar Herzog, focusing on Iberian empires, recently David Gilmartin's work on the Indus, have explored the riverine geography as sites to imagine political dangers, temptations for self-rule made possible by the coastal corridors, imperial territorialization, and hydraulic control. I'm condensing a lot of literature over here. I think, and please correct me here if I'm wrong, the tidal coasts of the Bengal might tell a different story. This 30-year legal case, therefore, serves as a cipher for me through which I can trace the dynamic unfolding and refashioning of metropolitan law's attempt to apprehend what they understood as an unknown geography and its vicissitudes in creating legal structures and geological knowledge. The legal battle surrounding Lakham's harbour also reveals a century-long process where multiple ways of understanding and living with the ecology of the tidal basin was condensed through contractual principles of ownership and scientific instruments of knowing and measuring space. In arbitrating the case, the colonial officials grappled with the following questions. Was geography an unstable and unreliable form of evidence? Or was it a matter of human miscalculation, whether purported or otherwise, in order to make wealth out of mud and profit out of geological indeterminacy? In deciphering this landscape and the water bodies as they emerge in the legal debates and the remembered histories of the place, we see the entanglements of geographical science, scientific development of maritime measurements, and law. This case also laid the groundwork for geographical formations in the tidal delta to become part of the legal, governmental, and scientific authority of the empire, thus slowly transforming the relation between land, water, and forms of possession that inhere in those spaces. So this paper is divided in two sections. I call the first section geography as evidence, and the second one I call measurement in a corrupt world. I closely follow the various arguments and legal reasonings used in Lakham's case, including the depositions, refutations, expert and lay witnesses, and I use the term expert and lay within quotes, I'll explain why later, offered in the legal proceeding by Lakham, the company servants in Calcutta, the merchants, the sailors, and the surveyors. And these depositions, I read them as sets of information about what they perceived as an indecipherable ecological difference. The lawmakers in Calcutta and London then attempted to translate these sets of information into particular legal semiotics of property and how to manage these swamps. The debates about the geological features of the tidal delta and signs of harbour construction became sites for producing legal testimony, arbitration around ownership disputes, and compensation. This case also illuminates two emerging aspects of colonial power at the turn of the 18th century. First, the politico-social world that the company was establishing as an expanding imperial power in South Asia, and second, a particular colonial social network where nature, ecology, and property all emerge as historically contingent categories, created in and through debates and discussion between lawmakers, company servants, petitioner, mariners, and all the kind of people involved. As we will see, each of these groups had different ways of reading the material landscape. So this brings me to my first section, geography as evidence. So Benjamin Lakham arrived in Calcutta in 1760, 13 years after establishing himself in various roles. As a draftsman in the new construction work on Calcutta, he actually worked in building the new Fort William. He made his way down to the mouth of the delta. Mouth of the delta to the newly acquired farm of South 24 Pargana territory, which also included the mangrove forests of Sundarbans. He ventured into the tidal waters east of River Hooghly to Borotala Creeks. And Borotala Creeks would be in this area, this channel creek that you see over here, that's Borotala, that's another name for Borotala Creeks. He familiarized himself with the landscape for a few initial years by setting up a lime works factory, then applied for a grant with the EIC and eventual plans to build his harbour, privatise a piece of coastline, hold private rights to the company's public works. If we turn to this trilingual map from F. Barlow collection, F. Barlow is a very interesting character who followed everything Lakam did, hated Lakam, and therefore kept copious notes of on everything, and I thank him for that. Yeah. So I really like this trilingual map because I haven't seen so many trilingual maps from this period. If we turn to the trilingual map, we see the River Hooghly, whose western banks were fast silting up throughout the 18th century. On the eastern side, the narrower Channel Creek flanking a small sanded known as Shagor Island. This is where the European boats left the bay to navigate their way to Calcutta through the inland river channels. So where is Shagor? Can I see it? Can I locate it? So Shagor would be somewhere here. And this is, and that is the main channel. And if you see those small dotted areas, that's where the sandbanks were. The larger ships often needed a pilot boat better adapted to the tides and the shoals and the shifts in the river's movements to navigate the European merchant and their goods back and forth from Calcutta. The shipping and country boat industries were booming in the Bengal Delta throughout the 18th century. Khejuri, which is on the left-hand corner over there, one of the major anchorages in the Hooghly side of the river, which handled the highest amount of trade at that time, was fast silting up. Every mariner and shipjobber was familiar with the vagaries of the Hooghly River and the treacherous entry to Calcutta. Lakam's proposed harbour was about 26 miles inland from the Bay of Bengal, and it would be closest to Calcutta at that time. The turbulent waters of the tidal rivers, cyclones, and the raging Bay of Bengal had sunk many a ship and a great deal of precious trading material before reaching Calcutta. So to briefly show, this was the yellow track, if you can see the yellow track, that's the older track. And Lakam was proposing to go up here, and that red spot is the area of the new harbour. And what's often, when you see this kind of dotted reefs, these are sandbanks, and that was the way of saying that these will move, these might not exist, these are not permanent, while the imagination was these are much more permanent lines, and we can often raise questions about what's permanent, what's impermanent in this area. So, and therefore, if you took Lakam's track, you would have to cross less sandbanks, and therefore the route was supposed to be safer. Lakam began surveying the channels, making soundings of the area to fathom its depth of water at both high and low tides while working as a contractor of lime to the company. Although a comprehensive survey of the area was yet to be conducted, Lakam's analysis was built upon existing small-scale surveys. The first survey was conducted with great difficulty by Robert Barker in 1956. This was followed a year later by the statistical survey of landholding by William Falkland, who became appointed as the tax collector of 24 Parganas. There were two other surveys. One was a nautical survey by Marine Surveyor Captain John Richards, a hydrographical survey of the area, which was conducted between 1767 and 1770. And the other, much more famous, much more extensive in scope, was of course Reynolds' survey of the Lower Bengal Delta, which was begun in 1764, conducted over a period of 13 years. Lakam's survey drew very tactically and selectively on Ritchie's survey to make his case. While he borrowed and corroborated his facts with Ritchie's work, he had heated exchange of letters with Reynel, and both of them had refuted each other's claims of depth. They shouldn't have been here, but this is basically Lakam's land grant or lease that he gets from the East India Company to the land he's talking about. And then here are his two, these are the two pictures that he draws and submits. These are not pictures of the completed thing. These are map proposals that he submits to the East India Company. This and the other image of what his harbors would look like and how many ships can be put in that wharf at one time. Lakam was not wrong about drawing upon earlier surveys. Surveys during that period were a collaborative effort across generations based on collection, collation, collaboration. As Thomas Best Jarvis, he was an engineer of the East India Company from 1819 to 1830, mentioned, geographical science is the simultaneous exertion of many individuals, wholly unknown to each other, to institute inquiries preparatory to that enlarged and more exact acquaintance with the relative situation of countries and objects on the surface of the globe, its precise form, dimensions, distribution, and local peculiarities. These all have followed successively at intervals as investigations supposed to have originated in fortuitous circumstances which some one or other of the foregoing causes has contributed to elicit or suppress. And I quote this because for me, it is way more interesting to see what engineers and surveyors are saying about geography rather than what geographical science is perhaps at that time is saying about geography, because there is always this gap and where a lot of interesting things happen. This account coming a few decades later, after Luckham describes the nature of the task Luckham had undertaken, who was neither a geographer nor a trained surveyor, but based his findings upon earlier claims, that of Ritchie's mainly, and as he cited, the knowledge he gained from long, long experience. The question of experience or tacit knowledge of landscapes versus scientific knowledge of landscape was still an ongoing debate in the late 18th century. For instance, in a contemporaneous case called the Folks versus Chad, fought over the silting of the Norfolk Harbor over here, the fisherman's knowledge of built upon years of experience was considered more valid in comparison to what they said the London-based geographers and their scientific abstractions. Law courts, therefore, are an important site to understand the formation and reception of geographical and geological knowledge. The petition that Luckham finally submitted contained first-hand witness depositions about the tidal landscape. These depositions from the merchants and marine surveyors attested to the difficulty of crossing the bay into the river to get to Calcutta and to the limitations of navigating the tidal basin. To summarize, some of the difficulties was, of course, you would have to constantly do a sounding of the depth, which was time consuming, which was expensive. The second problem was, apart from the sinking of ships, is if the high tide came and if it was, and the winds were right, and if you had to, because you were following the wind, you would have to leave immediately. You couldn't be stranded during monsoon. So if you're there in May or June and the winds are right, you will have to leave the coast, even if you've not unloaded your goods, and that was also very, very expensive. Commercial losses were also not the only reason. Because of the presence of the British and the Dutch, this harbour would also serve the military purpose. The idea was, because it was in a curve, it would be a good place. It gave a constant depth and ebb and flow, which would give you a good depth and motion to repair and do your fitting of your military fleet. So in the month of February 1774, he applied to the government in Fort William for a grant of 100 bighas. The company supported him and was very excited about his project. Through land grants, they supplied him chains for mooring, things for his gates for his dock, and various kinds of things to expedite his work. In February 1776, a month before its expected completion, he requested the board of directors for two things. First, he wanted them to support his application for another tract of land through a grant of 400 more bighas, which was substantially larger than the previous grant. Second, he wanted the company's master attendant to survey the channel up to his harbour, which might prevent any deception as to ownership. For the first time in his dealings, with the company, Luckham turned the rights vested in the land grant into a question of ownership. It is at this point that his New Harbour scheme became a flashpoint in a 30-year-long legal battle. The initial problem began to unravel when the director of the Calcutta Revenue Committee realized that the land grant would also include substantial amount of water. The surveyor who was discharged to the New Harbour unfortunately could not complete his survey or take measurements. He reported the mangrove forest in most parts were infested with tigers, and that the survey that Mr. Luckham asked for only respected land, whereas there was a lot of water bodies. Therefore, not only would such a survey cost more, as he said, but it would go beyond the spirit of the orders. So he comes back. And thereafter, of course, Ritchie goes and does the survey. Work on Indian and Atlantic Ocean has already unsettled the idea of bounded land-based empires and revealed the fractured legal geography coexisting with unregulated spaces. This has opened the space to study how both real and imagined spaces were products of non-metropolitan articulations of law, legal visions, and ad hoc nature of legal reasoning and jurisprudence. Recently, sociologist Renisa Mevani's work pushes the terrestrial and maritime divide in legal geography to focus on amphibian legalities, as she calls it, thus raising the question of how I or we attend to the specificities of a tidal swamp or the chore ecology of this area. And a lot of these sandbanks would often be termed as chore in Bangla. If chore was understood as geographical difference, how did it affect the question of law? In the case of Bengal, this means specifically how did the physical features that remain beyond the purview of contemporary geographical science, including a tidal moving landscape where land and water seemed inseparable, shaped property laws and developed a legal doctrine to settle land geographical disputes. We have very rich agrarian histories about Chaur and how revenue was drawn. I'm not going into that. I'm looking at how the Chaur was treated when it came to infrastructural and built environment. Lakham's failed infrastructural project organized questions of property environment law in the colonial and metropolitan court. The geographical specificity of the Bengal Delta demands that we frame the legal question differently. The question of ownership in temporary sandbanks, which were neither land nor water, had to be managed differently. In this, we see the concepts of delta, alluvium, river, tides emerge as both scientific concept but also everyday metaphors to understand geographical exception. These exceptions, moreover, require translation within law and infrastructural discussion in order to mediate metropolitan desires with the unstable ecology. In Lakham's case, for instance, for the soil, before the soil could be understood as measurable, mappable property and a productive entity, it had first to be produced materially and ontologically as soil. This was not the case in 18th century Bengala place, where the arrangement of space through abstraction as capital was always interrupted by the natural forces of the fluvial landscape that challenged any pre-given ontology of soil as firm ground, ready to plow or build upon. This is a mobile landscape where soil is temporary. What is soil today might be floating land-water admixture tomorrow, challenging all existing ideas of territorial and conceptual fixity, interrupting legal systems of registering land, drawing revenue, and scientific techniques of measuring water depth. The presence of water also threw up the question of use rights. As Ritchie's survey after the first survey pointed out in his deposition in 1777 about whether a grant should be made to Lakham. While he said he understood the relative advantages of the site, he could not address the question whether private property can be invested in the water bodies within the granted land in Channel Creek. He was concerned whether a land grant to Lakham could be given without invading the common rights of mankind. The problem of soil water admixture would continue to affect the workings of both the legal and the engineering departments of the company for the next century. The problem simply did not end there. If the definition of where land began and where water ended was a problem, then the geophysical challenge came from the flux in the measurement of water depth, a critical point affecting the navigability of the company's cargo ships and army fleets. James Rennell declared Lakham's sounding of the water depth unsound. Lakham claimed that one of the reasons why his new harbour was better suited for the task was that it boasted a more constant depth of water, which is necessary for a harbour. Lakham used the conventional lead and line to fathom the depth of water. Moreover, Lakham also claimed experiential veracity over Rennell's scientific abstraction, and Rennell was trying to also experiment with new instruments of measure. So he was doing lead and line with chronometers, clocks, and various other things. The courts fought a long and bitter battle starting 1777 over the depth of water, which failed to yield constant measure. So out of the 750 pages of material in Lakham's file, at least 20 to 30 pages are just measurements of depth and fights over the list of whose measurement. Very boring. As it turns out, marine sounding in the legal records were no innocent evidence and entered the courts entangled in debates around law, compensation, thus muddying the boundaries between marine science and fiduciary concerns. By the time the case reached London, the question that the question and controversy surrounding Lakham Channel Creek opened up were as follows. Can the evidence of geographical science be trusted? And if science was not corrupt, and that was a term often used about science at that time, should the judges then argue the case as a matter of individual accountability and honesty? All of this had to be settled in order to secure ownership in the land-water admixture or pay Lakham his annuity. And this brings me to my second section, measurement in a corrupt world. Human accountability is written into the history of instrumentation. The law of evidence standards played a very important part in this history. And historians have shown that how this is very co-constitutive. However, what happens when measurement or the failure thereof are written into the history of property and ownership? In order to begin to deal with this question, let us turn to the unfolding of the case and subsequent arguments and debates that restructured the modality of owning in this delta. The history of European naval technologies remain deeply enmeshed with the changes confronted when discovering new environments, and that demands careful attention to the materiality of land and waterscapes. Historian of science, Lauren Dastow, suggests that this careful attention involves a two-step cognitive process. First, a parsing out of a temporal moment when an act of naming or developing a geographical taxonomy of a particular feature happens. And she's talking about the development of colonial meteorology in the 19th century. And she was also talking about globalizing ways of seeing clouds and patterns in it and developing various kinds of, the various names of clouds as we know it. And in my case, I'm trying to understand the same feature about how Lakam, seeing a space as a naturally forming harbor, took shape. This is a classificatory act that condenses and flattens out variety and variability embedded within this landscape. The second step, as Dasna points out, is a moment of gathering of scientific data through standards, measurements, customs to establish a particular visual literacy about the landscape, or what in this case I'm going to call a scientific and geographical bracketing of the space. Lakam demarcated, surveyed, named a particular land water formation as the new harbor, a moving landscape as a fixed geography. This was a moment, as Dasto in her study of clouds said, of anchoring permanent words to impermanent things once and for all. In the act of calling this space a harbor, Lakam condensed the variety embedded in this marshy mobile landscape, but also attempted to flatten out its temporal variability. In describing the scientific project of developing a global language of colonial meteorology, historians of science have also pointed out the centrality of what they call a collective willed ontology of seeing, parsing, and naming nature. In Lakam's case, we get a glimpse of that same project of willed ontology that failed to globalize. And I think it's important to also, now that we all write global histories, or we are all trying to look at things that fail to globalize or that resist the kind of global history. And here you see, like, there was so much confusion of what to do with the tidal delta. This was not just an act of labeling the tidal swarm, but also the production of a collective act of seeing this space as a harbor. The language, the metaphors, and the frames that Lakam and some of his supporters developed but failed to globalize were, some called it the naturally forming harbor, others called it a place so well formed in nature. But some of his detractors just called him a place entirely of his own making. The Bengal Delta is, after all, a mobile landscape. What is silt today is swamp tomorrow and perhaps headed for the bottom of the Bay of Bengal in future. By developing, however indeterminately, a system of measuring the depth of the water to account for this space's practicality as a site for harbour, Lakam attempted but failed to forge a common geographical consensus. It was, therefore, this act of collapsing the rich variability of this ecological world that would animate some of the discussions around navigational metrics of measure and the legal terminology of accountability or human error. The judges in Calcutta convened a committee in 1783 to hear oral evidence and look into the papers about this case, which, as I said, in its final form runs to 750 pages. Upon consulting the material, the committee divided the evidence into three categories in order to extricate the nature of geography and human error. In the first two sections, the evidence were primarily geographical, and some of the stuff I've been detailing about the dangers of this older entry and the advantages of Lakam's proposed new entry. In the third section, the case is entirely debated, third section in the evidence is entirely debated on human accountability. How did Lakam get access to the land? Was it legitimate? Did he lie to get the grant? And what sort of corruption might have existed in giving him the land grant? And they were basically trying to parse out the geographical part and the human error and separate that out in the evidence. After the first failed survey, as I pointed out, John Ritchie again surveyed the space. And while he said it was suitable, he refrained from commenting on the political expediency or economic viability for a harbor. Based on Ritchie's report, the board did give him the land grant. But while this land grant was meant to include both landmass and water bodies within the purview of the grant, Ritchie said he had his reservations. Although Ritchie had not conducted a formal cadastral survey of the area, but for a long time he had been producing every couple of years these kind of hydrographical surveys of this area, starting from the Persian Gulf up to the Bay of Bengal and further on. He was very familiar with the mutability of land and water in this landscape. And he, even though he might not have had the terminology to explain the geological nature of the tidal delta, the changes it wrought upon the Earth's surface, Ritchie's long familiarity had made him sensitive to the gap that might exist between the financial legal instrument of a land grant and the tidal landscape or the mangrove landscape we are talking about. Moreover, he kept talking that it would also invade upon common rights of man to water in this land grant. Ritchie was one of the three critical voices of concern that stalled his project permanently. The second one came from Major Rennell, who raised doubts about Lacombe's measurement, as I pointed out. And of course, the debate, I won't go into the debate, but the debate was every time they went and took measurements, the measurements came out very different. And they didn't realize if they were not using correct instruments, if they were lying, if there were lazy surveyors out there, or what was going on, or because they had personal grudges against each other, they were trying to shape the landscape differently. The final came from Lord Cornwallis, the then governor of Bengal, who doubted Lacombe's personal integrity due to what he took to be the dubious nature of his profit motives for this venture. Swamps, it seems, produced murky characters who appear in official records as political threat. Is this Cornwallis's? Cornwallis said the passage into Lacombe's new channel was attended with imminent danger and consequently pronounced the scheme to be visionary and ill-founded, and so far from being likely to yield influence and credit to Mr. Lacombe or those concerned with him, the prosecution of it, I conceive, would more probably have entailed ruin and bankruptcy upon them. Cornwallis further added that Lacombe's persistence in the plan, even after seeing the service denouncing it, is further proof of how much men engaged in schemes of a speculative advantage may be led astray, how liable they are to have their judgment warped in favor of plans which their own zeal have projected. With this, the company decided that it was right to revoke his land grant, dismissed his petition, but they also offered him a handsome annuity of £600 in compensation. After this, Lacombe returned to England, attempted to settle his debts rather unsuccessfully, almost went to the debtor's prison. And then in 1803, he heard that there were ships passing through his channel. So he goes back to the House of Commons and then again tries to unsuccessfully petition his case. And there is another reconsideration of all the records. And then the House again dismisses his petition, but raises his annuity to £1,000. I'm very interested why he gets this annuity, and I have some theories about it. After that, Lacombe disappears from the archive, and by 1806, the new harbour goes down to the bottom of the river and is completely washed away. And as of today, there are no physical traces of this harbour ever existing. It's not like Port Canning, which was built, and the flood then moved the river, and therefore you see a Port Canning and bang in the middle of land. It's not like that. So to conclude, looking back at these records, it is surprising why the mobility of the landscape did not feature in the discussions about the factuality of water depth or the search for accuracy with instruments and the endless nerve-wracking discussions about the character of Lacombe. Or why, for that matter, he was given an annuity at all. Was it because the courts could not distinguish between geographical and character instability? One probable explanation might have to do with the absence of any cognitive frames for understanding and capturing a tidal mobile landscape. Geological and earth sciences had yet to produce theories or narrative frames to explain the rapid influx that defined the deltaic landscape of Bengal. The slow-moving changes wrought by the aqueous and igneous elements that created the earth's crust as a gradual process of accumulation and erosion did not also enter popular discourse until the publication of Charles Lyell's Principles of Geology in 1830. Before that, in the late 18th century, there were debates within the scholarly circles about catastrophism and uniformitarians who were Newtonian geographers who wanted to measure and mathematize, and they were talking about erosion, deposition, and movements of landscape. Thus, the sailors, lawyers, hydrographers, bureaucrats involved in the case did not know how to explain the discrepancy of measurement outside the frames of accuracy within a language of metrics of instruments and the lens of integrity of rhetoric of human morality, greed, and character. It is perhaps difficult to speculate whether they were inhibited by bureaucratic constraints of codification or scientific terminological limitation. What we can deduce from the available sources is that this mutability and flux became pivotal in Lacombe's venture. For Lacombe, Channel Creek and its shores were a naturally forming harbor. For his detractor, it was a place completely of his own making. Both statements are perhaps true, depending on one's interpretive frames at that time. It is astonishing that accuracy and character integrity were the only two possible ways to debate the situation in New Harbour, particularly since the vernacular, literary, and folkloric landscape is rich with riverine metaphors that attest to the sand and silt that often overtake the river. The English geographical terms of erosion and deposition fail to capture the range of riverland, intimate riverland experience that are contained in Bengali. And here, like, I draw upon the works of anthropologists, but also C.R. Abrar and Narula Azad document the multiple ways of understanding erosion in Bengali, signaling the diverse experiences of living with river. So Chapa Bhanga is a word which is used to explain when river breaks away chunks of land up to 2 meters wide as it flows during the rainy season. Bhanga, on the other hand, refers to a form of erosion that wipes away a couple of acres of land in a matter of minutes and is experienced the devastation that the monsoon brings. Harya Bhanga symbols strong undercurrents that sweep the soft and sandy bottoms of the river. There is something called Bhurburi Bhanga, where you see the bubbles coming up and eroding the landscape. So what I am trying to show with these various kinds of words, there was already within, if we look at the linguistic register, there was already a way of understanding that the land and the water had a much different relation by which erosion and deposition at all can understand. And therefore, later in the 19th century, we see people developing the alluvian and diluvian laws to manage the landscape, which is 1820, much, much later. In the vernacular geological understanding, and here that's why I said lay and expert is something I put within quotes, and I use the term geological specifically to talk about this, water and land shared a much more polyvalent relation, each moving and shaping the other both slowly and catastrophically. These theories existed much before 19th century. British men of science like William Wavell, James Hutton, Lyell attempted to break away from catastrophism and form uniformitarian theories of the Earth's crust. Admittedly, it is difficult to translate and perhaps communicate in writing a language that is steeped in this watery vocabulary. Yet it is precisely this wateriness that helps us remain attuned to the mobility of land, water, and everything in between the bounded space of land and the contained space of water. Contingency and indeterminacy are not only encapsulated in the rim where the land and water mix, but also in language and in a knowledge system. It is these structures of knowing that shape and are shaped by a sensitivity to the fate of place in these larger discourses of space. For the merchants of the East India Company, the changing depth of tides appeared as an anomaly that could be fixed either through better instruments or through law. In the case of New Harbour, such an anomaly led to an intense discussion around economic measures and legal instruments that might prevent further cases of this nature. And soon after, within a couple of years, they will start setting up the department that will start measuring tides and which will continue to become much more formidable. Ownership of such lands with water content exposed the limits of the land grants. While the variability in the landscape needed fortification, strict methods of computing depth and tidal measurement, as the British would realize over the next century, only law could tackle this landscape to colonial advantage. And here I think the argument that legal historians have been putting forward about geography and law is sort of turned around its head. The contestation of the apparent ecological vagaries of the tidal delta reveals that geography, instead of determining law, became actually a productive site for legal argument and reasoning. Indeed, law courts also became the site for the production of geographical knowledge. Where are the voices of the indigenous people who've been living with the land, water, fish, tigers for centuries, or who have been living in the land that Lakam occupied? The only time we have any intimation about what the indigenous population thought about Lakam's venture is when we get a texture of the land-water interaction that the legal and infrastructural debates cannot capture. John Ritchie ends his second deposition to the House of Commons with this statement, by which time, of course, the harbour has gone underwater. It is curious enough to observe the ideas, I think I have it. It is curious enough to observe the ideas with which the country people, entertain of the sinking of the wharf in Channel Creek. Mr. Lakam, they say, having erected a very tall flagstaff and hoisted colours upon it within the districts of the Ganjisab, without first making proper oblations, etc., to the deity, he in a rage at once sent the whole work to the bottom of the river as a chastisement of so great a presumption. Ganjisab could only be a reference to River Hooghly. The message in Ritchie's account by the unnamed country people is that the forces and energies of the river challenge the idea of ownership of landed property, since what is land today through the drying of yesterday's silt carried down by the river is now on its way to be deposited to the bed of the ocean. Riverine spirits acted as an ethical limit to human design and greed in the tidal delta. These sacral obstructions should not be read simply as political cunning on calculus of resistance by the indigenous population, but perhaps forces us to pay attention to the non-referential forms of obligations that inhere in the spaces. They seem to be telling Lakam that land in this region is not atemporal, and one must learn to live with the temporariness of land and its flow. Even if law abstracts silt into allodial rights, nature can always subvert it. Thank you.